worshipped. I want to be loved.
I've told you a million times not to talk to me when I'm doing my lashes.
Oh, it's you. I didn't know you with all your clothes on.
We're all busy little bees, full of stings, making honey day and night.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
What am I going to tell you? You look like a woman.
Well, girls, looks like it's back to the perfume counter for me. And by the way, there's a name for you ladies, but it isn't used in high society, outside of a kennel.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Goldwyn Girls. I am your co-host, Meredith, and today I'm joined by my trusty co-host, Amelia. And on today's episode, we have another very special guest, and this time we have Will McKinley, not the president or former president, Will McKinley, but an even cooler guy, a cooler Will McKinley. He is kind of a jack of all trades, a video producer, writer. He does a lot of freelance work with some really cool companies and everything basically film-wise. Welcome to the podcast, Will.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate the shout out. Only classic film people will recognize presidents from, like, you know, the late 1800s. But I'm excited to be here. I love what you guys are doing with this podcast. It's very fun, creative. I've enjoyed the episodes I've listened to. So thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, yes. Will.
We've been
wanting to meet you for a long time. And you just keep avoiding us. I think I can't really tell if it's on purpose or not, but
it's weird because I've known you guys. I feel like I've known you guys since you were in, like, middle school. I mean, almost literally, I've known you both since, like, 2012, right? And we met on Twitter, as I've met so many great people. And I went to the TCM Film Festival for the first, like, 7 years, and then couldn't go the last couple years when you guys were there. And then, of course, I had a pass for 2020, but we all know, you know, what happened there.
I know. I feel so bad that you had to read my tweets from 2012. Like, I go back and read them and I'm just like, ugh, like, no one should have been allowed to follow my Twitter.
Well, let me say this, you know, both of you guys have benefited greatly in my life from people, you know, taking me seriously at a young age, you know, and people encouraging me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw very clearly in both of you guys that you were, you know, a lot of people are sort of like, you know, they dabble. They're like, oh, this week I'm going to be into, like, classic culture, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, I could tell from very early on that both of you guys, you know, had a genuine interest and knowledge in this. And that, I like that. And it's, we need, you know, we need new generations of people interested in old movies and classic TV and classic culture and everything. And, you know, I really hate when people are, like, snotty or snobby or like, oh, you don't know. How can you not know blank, whatever? You know, that does not, those sort of, like, gatekeepers are, you know, the worst thing that can happen in any interest in any fandom, you know?
Yeah.
So good job being.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
That is, like, our motto. I feel like we don't like gatekeeping because it's just, like, basically not allowing your interest or the interest of the community or whatever eclectic group you're in to continue on. It's like, why would you want to self-implode your own interest? But I just wanted to say thank you for being so supportive. I think you were one of the first people I ever reached out to about wanting to be in film. Then I wanted to be a film historian when I reached out to you, but then I realized you have to write a lot of books and I don't really want to do that. So I was, you know, you kind of gave me a guide, or you were very encouraging at my young age to kind of figure all this stuff out. So, and you continue to support me and Meredith, and you helped me with writing my film thesis, whether you realize that or not, because you have a very great thread on streaming services on your Twitter. So,
oh, great. Well, I'm glad to I'm glad to have, you know, anything positive. I'm glad to have done it.
We wanted to kind of ask you, since we met you basically on Classic Film Twitter, I think it was having to do with like TCM Party and stuff like that. How did your interest in classic films kind of begin?
Well, classic film as like a family heirloom that's passed down from generation to generation is a common story. I know for you guys, Amelia, you talked about your grandfather. I know Meredith talked about your grandmother, right, Meredith?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
For me, it was my father because, you know, my father was born in 1929. So when he grew up, you know, classic film was just film. I mean, that was like he was living through that. You know, he lived through the Depression. He lived through, you know, the days when, you know, the Marx Brothers were in the movie theaters and, you know, the Little Rascal, the Our Gang comedies were in the movie theaters. And so my parents adopted me in 1969. And when I, from my very earliest childhood, you know, he basically sort of modeled this for me. And he wasn't like, you should watch The Little Rascals because, you know, they're groundbreaking comedic geniuses. He would just watch them, you know, and he would watch Abbott and Costello and he would laugh and he would just laugh like his ass off. And, you know, and I was like, oh, my father likes, you know, these old things. And so he just modeled it for me. And it was really, you know, it was a lot of comedy. It was universal horror. And I became from, you know, they like you see all these clickbaity articles about like, why don't millennials like old movies? Ugh. And, you know, if that is in fact true, I think it's about exposure. You know, when I was little, I grew up with the language of these movies from my earliest days. So it wasn't like at 10 or 11, somebody said, here, take a look at this old relic that has no, you know, stylistic connection to your current frame of reference. And here, you should like it. That is not the way you make a classic film fan. You got to do it from birth. And you see people on social media, maybe some people that you follow, they have babies and like the indoctrination starts from like out of the womb. Right. It's like, yes. I just showed my baby Night of the Living Dead. I'm like, what the fuck? But it's like, that's how you have to do it.
Yeah. That's how it happened to me. Yeah. Like, I would turn on cartoons like, you know, Cartoon Network at my age, like, you know, 5 or 6, because I wanted to watch those cartoons that other people my age were watching. I would leave the room for maybe 1 minute. I come back and TCM's on. I didn't turn it to TCM. My grandpa would just come into every room and start turning it on to TCM, or he'd tell me, I'm taping something. You bring up A Night of the Opera as a life-changing film that you watched, and I had the same exact experience. I had mine a little bit later, not maybe as a child, but I was shown Night of the Opera in high school, and I was like, oh my God. This is something I saw it in a new perspective. All of a sudden, everything changed, and I just had to consume classic films.
I mean, I will tell you, for, you know, for me, like we all have our like our origin stories, right? And by the way, for those of you who aren't seeing video, since this is not video, I'm air quoting. So yeah, all of us have like our classic film origin story. And for me, yes, I watched, you know, Abbott and Costello and Little Rascals and, you know, whatever. But for me, when it really clicked was when I was 9 years old, we went with my father to Puerto Rico for a business trip. And we were in the hotel and my parents wanted to go to the casino to gamble. And they were like, what are we going to do with, you know, the kids, me and my sister? So there was a little movie theater in the hotel and it was like a boardroom, like a conference room, right? With a big conference table and a 16mm projector, right? And they were showing A Night at the Opera. And my father was like, oh, you'll love this. You'll love, you know, the Marx Brothers. I used to like them when I was little. So, you know, they left me there, like, in the care of a bunch of old ladies who were sitting in the room, you know, like, it's like, oh, the Marx Brothers from our childhood. And I just laughed my ass off for like 90 minutes. I laughed so hard that like my chair fell over, literally. And I was like on the floor writhing. And the old ladies were like laughing at me more than they were laughing at the movie. And when my parents came back to pick me up, they were like, oh, thank you, old ladies, for taking care of our child. And they were like, we had such a good time watching him watch that movie. It's so, you know, nice to see younger people enjoying older mm-hmm. stuff. And that was it for me. I think I really, 9 years old, like, you're just beginning to have that sensibility, right? Where you're like, you get satire, you get sarcasm. And it felt like I was like, because I always had a tendency to be a smartass, and Groucho like personified the smartass as the winner, as the, you know, as the success, as the smartest mm-hmm. guy in the room. And I immediately latched onto that.
It's interesting that you, at the age that you discovered them, because it's funny because like the Marx Brothers are also one of the most important figures in my life as well. And I so really appreciate that. But like my discovery of them came the summer before my senior year of high school, which was, 2011? And I went to the library, and our library has just a really good selection of old movies. And I remember just getting all of the Paramount, all their Paramount movies. And I didn't really even know much about them before that point. And I started obsessively watching those movies. And I finally eventually got into the MGM ones, but I just would go back to the Paramount ones, and, you know, like the Coconuts, Animal Crackers, just all of them. And I would just go back and forth, and just like, I don't know what it was, but I was like, oh, I've never felt so strongly about people before. And for some reason to this day, Animal Crackers like remains my favorite movie of theirs. I don't know what it is about that movie. But I just like, I really appreciate other people who get into the Marx Brothers like as strongly as I do. So
yeah, that's And when I discovered them, so it was 1978, I was, you know, whatever grade I was in, in the late 70s, you could still, like, classic film was not this, like, bizarrely niche thing. You could go into, like, a mainstream bookstore, and there'd be all kinds of books about old movies. You could go into a, you know, Spencer's Gifts or whatever and mm-hmm. see posters of the Marx Brothers, you know? And mm-hmm. it was like, it was still part of our culture, and they were on TV. Now, even as, you know, long ago as like 1978, if you wanted to see the Marx Brothers movies, they were on like the Late Show at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I came home from Puerto Rico and I was like, so here I am, I want to see all the movies from these people, but there's only one way to see them, and it's like at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I was like, I hustled my parents, and I was like, here's the deal. I'm going to set my alarm. I'm going to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'll go to bed 2 hours early, so it'll all like even out, and it'll all work great. Trust me on this. And they were like, you know, my mother was always very, very encouraging. So they were like, that's cool. No. So then, of course, I would get up and watch the movie, and then discover the other stuff that was on TV, like after the old movies. And it would be like old TV shows like Burns and Allen and, mm-hmm. you know, and The Life of Riley with Jackie Gleason mm-hmm. and The Abbott and Costello Show and You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx. And it became, you know, it became my culture. And I mentioned that, you know, I'm adopted. And so I've always had this, I don't know, like, we're not going to get into like making this like a shrink session or anything, but I've always had this feeling of being sort of out of place, or, you know, like I have no connection to, I mean, I love my family, but I don't have any biological connection to them. So I was like, I feel a little bit out of time in life. So I immediately was like, yeah, all right. So I'm going to be like, I'm going to exist in the 1930s and 40s. And I mean, that's like, that sounds weirder than it really was. I was a normal kid and I like played baseball and stuff, but I just, I resonated to this, you know, and I still do 40 years later.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because I feel a similar way. I mean, I wasn't adopted, but when I was in high school, and I say this a lot, but I was really depressed and I almost dropped out. And there's just something about classic films that was easy to relate to with me. And everything else just seemed really hard. And so I was like, why would I want to live in a time that's really difficult for me when I can be transported to literally any other time or any other world? And so I think in a similar way, it was more of an escape for me because I didn't understand at the time that I had ADHD and why things were a lot harder for me than other people. But having those classic films there really helped me get through a lot of it and get in trouble for not paying attention to class. So,
yeah. And, you know, and I think, and Meredith, I listened to one of the episodes where you talked about like discovering the Marx Brothers and going to like the library and, you know, whatever. And, you know, it became a quest for me. And this actually leads into your thesis a little bit, Amelia. It became a quest for me to see everything and get all the books. And so I would go like, I would troll around like used bookstores to find these old relics and, you know, have to stay up until or get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, and it was just, it was the thrill of the hunt, you know, and it's very different nowadays where like, you know, if you discover the Marx Brothers, and that, by the way, so that process for me happened over years, right? Like a couple years. Nowadays, if you discover the Marx Brothers, like you can bang it all out in a day, you know? And I'm not saying that, gosh, I wish we could go back to, you know, the bad old days of the late 70s, but boy, there was something that was so childhood defining for me and life defining for me about that whole process. And it's just very different today, you know, and probably in good ways and probably in bad ways.
Yeah, I think, sure. You know, there's some pros and cons with it. The pro that I see is that I see a lot of people my age on film Twitter who, you know, my age and younger, you know, kind of around the time I got into classic films. And I'm kind of happy for them that the community is so much bigger now and they can meet people their age, because all I did was carry my giant pre-code books to high school with me and sit and read them by myself. And I didn't tweet into the abyss. And I kind of wish at that point I had a lot more people. Like, I'm really glad I met Meredith and Casey and some people I still talk to today, but I'm happier to see that a lot of them are able to make these connections probably when they need them most.
Yeah, so I feel like that was definitely a difficulty, and we've talked about this so much, but just like feeling like you're trying to make a connection with people, you're like, especially in person and online, that would really kind of bother me. I don't know, I'm a sensitive person in some aspects, and I remember, you know, just like as a teenager and into college, you know, I would sit there and like a lot of it was probably self-pity, where I was just like, you know, I don't feel like I really connect with people. And I wish people like would just want to talk about old movies with me in person. But, you know, and I've learned to kind of get over that. And like, you know, if I'm going to talk about films, then I'll talk about it with people that I know who want to, or it's, you know, make it work. But that's a really good point you bring up, Amelia, just how much bigger it's gotten. Sometimes like, I don't really realize just how much bigger it has gotten. I forget how long, like we've been active on there. I was a senior in high school when I got, I was a junior when I got Twitter, but I think late 11, early 12 was, I think, when I really started getting into it, which was senior year. And I don't know, it just doesn't feel like that long ago, but it's just,
I know. I'm crazy. Like, when will I get off the internet?
I know.
Well, I, you know, when I was little, there was like, so I was kind of a curiosity because, you know, I was so defined by these movies. And I remember like the year Zeppo Marx died, which was like, I don't know, 1980 or whatever. I remember like all the kids in school came up to me and they were like hugging me and giving me condolences. And I was like, it was so surprising to me because everybody knew how much I loved this. And they were like, we don't necessarily share this affection, but you know, it was like, they respected it, which was cool. And it also, I was very comfortable with it defining me. And I, you know, and I did try on occasion. I remember one time I was like, we're going to have a Marx Brothers sleepover marathon. And I had all my VHS tapes and invited all my friends over, and we had like sleeping bags in the living room. And I was like, I made up a paper schedule. Like, we're going to start with this. Yeah. And then I put the first movie on, and I was like, I'm going to start with the best one, and Night at the Opera, the one that I, you know, made me who I am today. And everybody was like asleep about midway through the movie. So then I like continued on with the marathon for like five movies, like sitting next to my like unconscious friends. And if that's not like, you know, if that was not sort of like a harbinger of what was to come in my life, I have no idea, you know?
I know. It's I'll move on topics in a second, but I have a similar thing with the Night of the Opera, because so my grandpa used to buy me VHS tapes. He gave me a Night of the Opera VHS tape at 7 years old, and I wanted all my friends to watch it with me. And I remember I had a friend over, and I was like, oh, can we watch this? And I brought out the VHS tape, and she was like, I don't want to watch that. It's in black and white. Why do you want to watch that? And I was like, ugh. I was like, wow. You know, that's some foreshadowing if I ever saw it.
But you know what? It's whatever. It's what makes us, you know, all the cool adults that we are now.
Will, I wanted to talk to you about soap operas so badly. Because I know you're the Dark Shadows connoisseur, along with many other soap operas. And I just want to say that I took a soap opera film class in college. It was supposed to be like a film analysis class. It was not a film analysis class. It was a soap opera class hiding as a film analysis class. The teacher just wanted to get it bypassed through the bureaucracy of the school and let him, he just wanted to talk to us about soap operas. But he showed us, he showed us Knot's Landing. He showed us Dark Shadows. I did my final paper on Dark Shadows. And I actually wanted to cry the last day of class because it was like one of the best film classes I've ever taken in my life. And I still stand by that today. And so as soon as I saw you posting about Dark Shadows, I just knew I had to talk to you about soap operas and how you got started into soap operas.
You know, my mother was a big soap viewer. And so again, like my father with the old movies, my mother with the soap, she sort of modeled it for me. And I would be kind of wandering through the room and, you know, and the soaps would be on. And so I just began to absorb them. And I would say that around the same time that I really became crazy about old movies, I also became crazy about soaps. And I found that, you know, they went hand in hand for me because a lot of classic film actors moved on to soap operas at the end of their career. You know, they were a great place for stars that were no longer getting hired, you know, by motion pictures to continue to work. Prime example being Joan Bennett on, you know, who was the matriarch on Dark Shadows, years after, you know, she was a sort of like a hot film star. And even people the other day were like, I forget what movie it was, but people were tweeting about like how hot like Hugh Marlowe was when he was young. He was on Another World when he was like 70. Kim Hunter was on The Edge of Night in a spectacular story when I was like 10 years old about, it was basically like a Norma Desmond character who came to town to make a movie and, you know, ended up being a crazy, it was just such an awesome story. So, you know, I really I got hooked on the, like, just the continuing soap operas are such a distinctly American art form. And, you know, I mean, the continuing story is certainly nothing new. And, you know, Dickens did a great job of doing that with, you know, and very many, many, many other people. But I was just really struck by the continuing nature of the storytelling, the way these, you know, characters became like daily, you know, friends in your life. And I just love the medium. And, you know, at one point at my height, we got a VCR for Christmas in 1980, I think. And it was like, I don't know, like $1,000, which I think today is equal to like $1 million. I don't know, but that's a lot. It's like my father was like, you know, I was like, we have to get a VCR. I have to record everything. And he was like, okay, but like, you're never going to get another present for like the rest of your childhood. And I was like, that's totally fine. And so at the height, I was recording 6 hours a day of soap operas. And then I would come home from school and I would like, I could do an hour in like 39 minutes with fast forwarding through the, you know, commercials and stuff. And I was just watching all of them. And it's like, again, like with the old movies, it's like, if I like something, I'm going to like the fuck out of it. You know, it's like, I'm never going to do anything halfway. And I just, it was a great, and it was also like, you know, when you're a teenager and you're like fighting with your parents and your mother, it's like, we would stop fighting when our shows were on. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I hate you. You ruined my life. Ooh, Another World's on.
It's cool how like that's such a way to bond with people. Like if you find something that you can all really enjoy, like I feel like sometimes there's nothing like the same. I don't know. Like there's just something really special about that. So I dig that.
You know, I remember my father once said to me, like, my father was a mechanic and he was a, you know, not an educated guy, but a very, you know, kind and sweet and supportive man. And he was like, you live in a fantasy world. And I was like, damn right, I live in a fantasy world, you know? And, and so anyway, but all, I never realized that like these early fanish pursuits would mm-hmm. end up becoming a career. They would end up creating a career for me. But they, in the case of old movies and soaps, both my interest in soaps, both of those things led to, you know, what has now been like a 35-year career. It's amazing to say that, but it's like, you know, because I'm mm-hmm. only 35 years old, which is fascinating how that works mathematically, but but yeah, so encourage your children in obscure or non-mainstream pursuits, because it is mm-hmm. very likely that they will find themselves in those. They will mm-hmm. discover who they are, and they will end up having careers that they're really engaged with instead of working some shit job that they hate mm-hmm. and being miserable alcoholic adults.
Mood.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I feel that. Like, so hard.
My grandpa always was, even though he loves film and is passionate about film, the odd thing is that when I was like, I'm going to major in film, he's like, don't do that. Just work at Google. I was like, I don't want to do that. Like, I'm going to like quit my job if I work at something I don't really enjoy. So like, I'm just going to do it. But one thing that I found interesting about soap operas in that class that I took was we read a lot about behind the scenes production and just like how small their budgets were and just how they figured it out and survived on those small budgets and still turned out a show some of them were every single day, if I'm right or correct. Just like how they pulled that off was really incredible to read about.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I was very lucky to experience that, you know, firsthand when, you know, my father, again, being the, like the influencer before we called them influencers. Right. he was like, I remember it was around Halloween. I think it was 1981. And we were watching TV, and there was a promo for House of Dark Shadows, the movie, the feature film version of Dark Shadows, that, by the way, like, saved MGM in, like, 1970. And he was like, oh, you should like, you, I think you'd like that because it's scary and you like soap operas, blah, blah, blah. So I watched it. I watched the movie first, and the movie is like crazy. Everybody died. I mean, it's bloody and, you know, and you talk to like people in their 60s and they're like, that movie like fucked me up as a child because I used to watch soap opera on TV and my mom took me to the movies and I was like, had child like a PTSD from House of Dark Shadows. But so I really dug the movie, and then much to my great joy, they started syndicating the reruns in 1982, and I watched the show and I was like, this is my show, I love it. And I started writing a fanzine of my own when I was like 13, and
cool.
And then became involved in, like, I found the fan community and ended up meeting the star of the show, Jonathan Frid, when I was like 14. And at that point I was writing for a fanzine, and he, like, we were planning like the first ever Dark Shadows fan convention in New York. And I was 14 or whatever. And he walked in like to the cafe where we were meeting, and he was like, oh, you must be Billy. Right. Cause that was my name. And he was like, oh, you're an excellent writer, he said. And I was like, first of all, ladies out there, because I'm single, and like, if you ever want to like get with this, like, just say you're an excellent writer and I will melt right there in front of you. So he knew how, I mean, Jonathan Frid was extremely charming and knew. He had a history, like when Dark Shadows was on the air, like kid fans used to like hang out outside the studio, and he would be like, okay, all you guys are coming to work for me this Saturday and answering fan mail. So he had a history of like putting the fans to work. So I started working for him, and that kind of was the beginning of my career when I was like, you know, 15 years old, which was awesome.
Okay.
I mean, I will tell you that, you know, you guys, like Amelia, you mentioned, you know, your grandfather was like, get a good job, blah, blah, blah. You know, I have very distinct memories of my father. Like, my father had to get up for work like every day at like 4:30 in the morning, you know, because he was like foreman at a bus garage or whatever. And he did that for like 44 years. And, you know, and I remember, you know, I found out at one point, my mother told me that like he wanted to open up his own garage, but he couldn't do it because, you know, he had kids he had to raise. And I was just like, this is not the life that I'm going to have. I'm not going to get up every morning at 4:30 to go to the same job for 40 years. I'm just not going to do that. And, you know, and so when I started working as a teenager, you know, for Jonathan Frid, and his manager at the time was a producer on the soap opera The Guiding Light. So I got to hang out there at, you know, the studio and talk to the people who were working there. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to do it in a way that every day is interesting and different and fun and exciting, you know?
Kind of decided, and I might change my mind, but I don't really want kids. I'm just like, that's a commitment I don't think I can do. I can barely commit to watching like the 600 films on my watch list that I currently have on there. So yeah, I decided that I'm probably just going to dedicate a lot of my life to my career, and it's kind of taken my family a little bit of time to accept that, even though I'm like the one with the crazy weird film tattoos and like my hair's dyed, and like they've had to slowly accept that I'm just gonna focus on my career. But I even, you know, I felt like I had to prove everyone wrong. I mean, where am I gonna put my film reels if I have kids living in a house? I don't like
Yeah, and you know what? And maybe maybe in 20 years or whatever, 10 years, 15 years, you'll be like, oh, now I feel ready. And then it's like everybody evolves as a person. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like,
yeah,
you know, you're never, nothing is, everybody is fluid being.
Yeah, I'm at the point where like I'm 27 and I feel like I am a hot mess. Like for, you know, like I've wanted for years to go into film, like I say film history. And, you know, I've looked at different things, film programming and stuff, and I've applied to places, but, you know, I talk a lot about this, like I struggle a lot with anxiety, and even though I was undiagnosed with ADHD, I think I feel very ADHD. For years I thought I had it, and I really struggle a lot with like self-esteem and everything and just going for things. And I think, like, unfortunately, like I've had a lot of issues where I feel like I know what I want to do, but I just never know how to get there. And, but I was going to say, so it's like, it's really cool to see people who do make careers out of it. Like I still look up to people, you know, like you will. And, you know, and I still like, I think I'm like, okay, there's hope out there. Like I can do something, even if it's, well, you know, even if I'm freelancing or doing it on the side, like I'll figure it out. But, you know, it's just a weird age to try to figure it out, I feel like.
Well, I will tell you two things. I will tell you, one is, now I feel like the old bearded man, like on the mountain, like giving a speech to you guys. But like, what I think works best is when you find the thing that you love and you like, I'm not gifted in any way necessarily. Like, you know, there's nothing where people are like, oh, you're a natural, like whatever. I just work. I'm willing to work very hard, and I work as hard or harder now as I did when Jonathan Frey gave me my first assignment when I was 15 years old, right? And mm-hmm. And I also feel like if you do that, it's like one of the things that interested or that caught my attention about both of you guys, even when you were young, was that, you know, you were on point with what you were talking about when you were young teenagers. And I think people see that, and I think that impresses them. Right. So you guys are doing a podcast that's funny and like kind of hip, and it's not this like fucking like 60-year-old man complaining about, you know, they're making a movie with Fred Astaire and he doesn't look like Fred Astaire. Like, you know, so and that's cool. And it's like you have the blog and it's like you're going to write a book about Ruby Keeler, and, you know, you keep doing your thing and, you know, people eventually will notice. And but also like hand in hand with that is, you know, being self-promotional and being unapologetically self-promotional and being aggressive and putting yourself out there. You know, there are people who are far less knowledgeable than you guys and far less talented than you, from my perspective, who are getting opportunities, right? So how do they get those opportunities? Usually it's about being aggressive. It's about networking. It's about, you know, asking for things. The greatest thing I've learned is, you know, ask for things. Like I had a couple professional interactions with Jonathan Frid, and then I sent him a letter and I was like, I want to work with you. I was 15. And he was like, all right, that's cool. What do you got? And, you know, so it's like, you know, whatever, it's, you both are coming from a great passion and a great place of knowledge. So be super aggressive in your pursuit of it, you know, because you've earned it.
Oh, thank you. That like hit home for me. I really mean that. And
yeah, there is no such thing as pushing too hard. You know, particularly on social media where, you know, you have to rise above the noise, you know, and it's just, it's like, and I get that it's hard. It's like, it is so, like, I did a podcast the other couple weeks ago and I worked really hard on like prepping for it. And it was like really good. And I was like, oh, this is like the best podcast I ever did. And then I like tweeted out and people, it was like met with like a giant yawn by the internet. And, you know, and I was like, oh my God, it's like nobody cares about my like perspectives. And, you know, it's like you have to just, mm-hmm. you have to keep soldiering on. It's like, you know, like, because you never know like what's going to resonate for people, what's going to hit, you know, you just have to keep doing it. And it's, be aggressive and unapologetic. And yeah. Can you hear the church bells in the background there? It's church
bells. I beg your hand. I love
this
that.
This is like fucking, this is like, It's a Wonderful Life. I'm giving you the Clarence speech. It's like, no man is, you know, a failure if he has friends. And the bells are playing. Mommy, every time a bell rings, Will McKinley gives a speech.
So what was kind of your, like, obviously you got into things, like you had a really cool start or origin story, as you say. With your work. And so what I see that you had brought up in the outline that you went to NYU and kind of, so was that sort of another springboard, like, you know, with NYU, did you do that and then, you know, find an internship or a job through there? Kind of what was next for you in that journey?
Yeah, all of the above. So, you know, when I started working for Jonathan and hanging out at Guiding Light at the studio, like I used to observe in the booth, which was very exciting for like a, you know, at that point I was like, I don't know, 17, 16. And I remember talking to the director, his name was Bruce Barry. I think he's still working. And I was like, oh, I want to do this, you know, what should I do? And he basically was like, go to NYU, get an internship, you know, and you'll have a career. And then like a couple other people in the booth basically backed that up. So I went back like that night to Jonathan's apartment and I said, so everybody at Guiding Light thinks I should go to NYU. What do you think? And he was like, oh, the producer of Dark Shadows is a TV teacher at NYU. So let's call him up. So he got on the phone and he called Robert Costello, who had been the producer of Dark Shadows, you know, whatever, 15 years, 20 years earlier. And he was like, it's a great idea. Unfortunately, like I'm retiring, so I won't be your teacher, but here's what you should do. And so I applied and, you know, my grades were not good. I went to an all boys Catholic high school that I hated and everybody hated me and I had no friends and I was like, fuck all of you. And so I didn't have good grades at all, but I did have like good credits. And one of the things that they had told me at Guiding Light was, you know, if you have a good resume, you'll get in even if your grades aren't good. So that's what I did. And I got in and, you know, and it was a 4-year, you know, film program. And like you, Amelia, you know, I sort of toyed with the idea of doing like cinema studies and all that. And the classes, I realized it was not for me, you know, that sort of like pointy headed, like analysis is just not my thing. You know, it's like, thank God there are people that do it and do it well. And we all know some of them, you know, but that's not me. I can fake it, but I can't really, I don't care. I don't want to analyze this movie, you know. I'll analyze how it was shot, but, you know, the like, whatever, meaning and stuff, that's not my thing. But yeah, so, you know, it was, and then when I was finishing up at NYU, I was like, I have to get an internship. So I got an internship at a talk show called Attitudes with Linda Dano, who was a soap star. And it happened to shoot at Kaufman Astoria Studios, which was the Paramount Astoria Studios, where the Marx Brothers had made their first, you know, few films. So it was like I was walking on sort of like hallowed ground. And then I got an internship at a company that made industrials, like corporate videos.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned into a job because they had a client who wanted to do a video with Marx Brothers clips, but nobody in the office knew anything about the Marx Brothers. And I was like, hi, I know about the Marx Brothers. And that ended up being like my big break in work, because I could quote chapter and verse of these Marx Brothers quotes. So a singer and dancer. And so like I got a chance to interview her, and her mom, who was Ruby Killer's daughter-in-law, and talk all about like, and you know, the girl in the Apple Sisters, I think her name was Sarah. She talked about like Ruby when, you know, she was near the end of her life, and then she ended up doing a video where she danced along with Ruby, which you can search that out probably on YouTube. And again, it's like, you know, it's another example of how things that you think are disconnected, like, connect.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen that. God, it's been forever, but I have seen that video on YouTube. I've watched that like multiple times over the years.
The girl in her 20s dancing to with Ruby, right?
Yes. It's like, it's got the 42nd Street scene projected behind her. Yeah. Oh, that was so cool too. I want to say, I actually feel like I need to get back to doing the Ruby research because it's been a little while. I've gotten so sidetracked, but I actually had looked her up because I was like, oh, it'd be interesting to, you know, if I can ever chat with her or something. And I think it is Sarah. I think it's Sarah Lowe. Yeah, I know that her, I can't remember how many kids she had had when she remarried. I can't think of his name, but Lowe. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's really cool. That's cool to just have that connection to be able to talk to family members and that she's able to still, you know, remember her grandma and do that same, the dancing and the singing. I think that's just like a really lovely thing. And it was a really great tribute.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like those I discovered. And when I talked to her mom on the phone, who had been Ruby's daughter-in-law, I guess, you know, those people just so, I think, greatly appreciate when you care, you know, because it, in a sense, it's like you're keeping these beloved people in their lives alive with your knowledge and interest. And, you know, it's definitely, you know, definitely worth pursuing, I think. So let me be the like encouragement for you to, you know, hit that Ruby Keeler stuff hard.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Cause I feel like there's not a lot out there about her. So I was like, you know, it might be kind of a good like avenue to go down. So,
and then you know what? It's like you write the book and people are like, I know, cause I do this myself. Cause the one thing I haven't done is write a book, and I need to at some point, but I'm like, oh my God, it's like, I'm not good enough to write a book. I need to work for 20 years. And you know what? People are banging these books out, you know, a couple a year. And I'm not saying do a bad job, but I'm saying it's like, get on the board, right? Because once you have your name on a book, people are like, author Meredith Riggs, you know? And it's like, and you get qualified by that, you know, by that. And it's just, I feel like sort of give yourself a deadline and, you know, and get it done, because it's like, it could be like the start of your sort of career as a historian. I mean, you've already started it and are well into it, but like professional acknowledgement of you, you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. 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 That's a really good.
Cool.
Yeah. I wanted to real quick talk about some more contemporary stuff that you've been working on. I know that you run a lot of social media for some companies and some television channels, and I've taken some of your quizzes, Will.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that a lot.
I feel really stupid when I take them, because I think I'm going to get a high score, and every time it's like 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10, and I feel like I like didn't even earn a degree at all. I just feel really dumb.
I mean, it's so interesting because it's like, you know, when I discovered Twitter in like 2009, I was like, I immediately realized that there was a, you know, that there was an active classic film community. And I started tweeting. I was probably like one of the first people to be tweeting about TCM back in like 2009, and found this whole community of people, including, you know, people who worked at TCM. And I got it into my head. I was like, this is exactly, because I had, in my corporate producing, Time Warner had been my account in the mid 90s. So, you know, I produced like the corporate video for the shareholders meeting in 94 and 95. And basically, and that was like 5 years ago, and it's just my relationship with the channel and some sister channels to it has just evolved and increased. And, you know, and then they were like, well, you do social media on your own, right? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, well, how about you do it for us? So, you know, again, I was like in my late 40s getting a job doing social media, which is typically done by people, you know, it's like typically the lowest rung, right, on in digital marketing. And it was just like, I felt like it was a challenge for me. And it was, you know, stuff that I liked, classic TV and, you know, and film. And, it, you know, I was able to use my, you know, years of like, you know, whatever, being in communications and marketing and PR and blah, 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 all that. And it was a great challenge. You know, I enjoyed like, you know, sort of figuring it out. That's always so important for me, like doing something and being bad at it from the beginning, but learning how to get it right. And, you know, and I'm very proud of, you know, what I've done over the last couple of years. You know, I, like you said, I write the quizzes for the, you know, and I write blog posts and do the social media, and I write the like program descriptions for the website, and doing this for a couple channels, as well as the, you know, the Facebook page for the TV show Good Times, you know, which is a favorite of mine. And, you know, I don't know, this is not necessarily what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I doubt I'm going to be like a 70-year-old man doing social media like, hey, what's up, fam? You know? But it's like it's been a fun couple years, and it will likely evolve into you know, something else. But the reason I made the TCM reference there is because I made the mistake of TCM. I had been working for years and years, was more than qualified to work at TCM, but I basically decided I was going to audition for them every day with my, like, I was going to write these really good blog posts and analyze their channel and blah, blah, blah. And then when this other channel reached out to me, like the first thing they were like, yeah, you know, like what you do for TCM, would you like be interested in doing that for us? And I was like, nope. I was like, you guys can pay me or you can find somebody else. And guess what? They hired me. So, you know, it's like, don't give your shit away for free is point number one. Know your worth, you know, and, you know, don't spend a lot of years barking up a tree that's not going to bark back, you know? So like, right. It's like, those are all important things that, you know, and I do not mean to sound like Mr. Advice, because I am a, you know, in many ways, like I'm a mess of a person. Like the fact that I've made it this long is astounding to me. But, you know, like if you can be as much of a mess as you are inside as I am and still be around after 35 years, man, you guys will have it sweet, because there's no way you're as bad off as I am.
Debatable. No. one thing I kind of wanted to talk about is with your work with the social media for the channels. This is kind of coming to a close, but streaming services, and I think the importance of linear television. I think like what you're doing with the social media channels is really important, or social media for the channels is really important, because that's how people ingest a lot of their news, or a lot of, you know, that's how they find out about events or find out about pop culture. And I think that it's important to still have those, to advertise as much as you can on social media for those channels, especially as streaming is becoming more competitive. But I know you have a mixed feeling about streaming. As do I.
And, you know, I mean, you and I could do a symposium on we could do a fucking like Winds of War 28-hour like miniseries on streaming. But
Let's do it.
I'm in whenever you want. But so here's the thing. It's like, you know, the channel that I work primarily for is like considered whatever, like a nostalgia channel. And, you know, nostalgia is a thing that makes everybody feel better. And whether you're nostalgic for That's So Raven or you're nostalgic for Gold Diggers of 1933, right? It's all the same. It's all the way it affects you is the same. And one of the reasons that these, you know, like nostalgia TV channels like MeTV and others, I think, succeed is because they get that, they understand that, and they talk to their audience. You know, it's like, yeah, it's like we try and be sort of hip and slightly current in presentation, and like I'm doing quizzes on the Instagram stories, you know, and stuff like that. But at the fundamental, at the basis of it is an older person talking to other older people about shit we all remember and that makes us feel good. And I think that's important. And that's why I say, like, don't think like social media is for young people. Like, social media is for everybody. You know, it's like my 75-year-old aunt is on social media. It's like, you know, and you need people to talk to those people in ways that is informed, that are, you know, ways that are informed. I try to not hide my age. I try to speak, like, I will say to people, you know, Charlie Brown Christmas, you know, premiered 55 years ago tonight. Were you watching? And people are like, oh, how old do you think I am? But guess what? twice as many people are like, fuck yeah, I was watching, you know, because they're happy to be addressed directly.
Mm-hmm.
So be inclusive. And that's, it's just such a, you know, and I mean that like in every way. That's just, yeah. And I do feel, and we've talked about this before, I think online, you know, people are like, so many commercials, you know, what the shows are edited in some cases, you know, whatever. Mainstream television is still the best way to expose new audiences to things that exist because, because people are just still like flipping around or whatever. And it's a way to discover, you know, if you make people go search things out in the bowels of, you know, mainstream streaming services, like it's great that Peacock and CBS All Access and HBO Max and, you know, Disney Plus, it's great that they all have classic content, and they do, and it's all and it's prevalent, but you're not going to seek that out if you've never, like, who's going to seek out Perry Mason if you never like wandered into the room when your grandmother was watching Perry Mason, right? It's like,
yeah,
you know, you need, and even like Peanut specials, it's like people are like, they used to, when they showed them on CBS, it was filled with commercials and they were edited. But guess what? It was like this thing that we could all do together at the same time for 50 years. And when you lose that, that's how you lose traditions, and that's how stuff goes from being mainstream to niche. And you know, like what you, like, you know, when I was little, everybody in school knew Abbott and Costello, and they would do the bits, right? Because they were on TV every Sunday. It's like now nobody knows who Abbott and Costello is unless you're old, because Universal basically like locks them up on DVDs and Blu-rays because they know they can make a predictable buck from 60-year-old men. You know, it's like that shit needs to be out in the world so people can see it and discover it and find it. And that's one of the great things that these like nostalgia channels do. You know, they show, they put these old shows out there and a lot of people find them, and it's, yeah, it's old people, but it's also young people.
That's a really good point with like the different events, like It's a Wonderful Life on NBC and like The Sound of Music, I think that's ABC, and like all around Christmas time. And I, so I've always felt that way, where I think there's some, there is something special about watching something live, because yeah, you know, like other, there are so many other people out there who are watching it at the same time. And I think especially around the holidays, like, because I'm very sentimental, and, you know, I get that way where it's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to settle in and watch. And I don't know, whether or not you're live tweeting or not, I always like doing that too. But I think that there, yeah, there is something really cool. And I think that's a really good point you bring about the traditions, and the, when those go by the wayside, that that's how people typically stop talking about it. That's like, it's a really good connection. I hadn't thought about that before, so that is really important, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, it's like the minute something goes from that mainstream platform, the minute it leaves that, it's like frozen in amber, right? It's like, it's a tradition for everybody who cared up until 2020, right? And then after that, as those people forget or get old or die or whatever, then it's like it becomes one less person and one less person and one less person and one less person. Whereas if it stays on CBS or whatever, you know, every year, it's still going. It's still, you know, it's still happening. It's still current. And It's a Wonderful Life is a great example. Nobody cared about that movie. Then it became public access, public domain. And it was on, like, I remember, like, 1988, I was, like, flipping my TV Christmas Eve, and it was on five different channels, all at, like, different spots in the movie. And then all of a sudden, everyone's like, oh, my God, this is such a great classic. Trust me, you know, 40 years ago, not everybody knew It's a Wonderful Life, and now they do. And how they do that is because it was on a lot of TV channels. It's all about It's all about access, you know? It always is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's why streaming is dangerous, as you've said in your thesis.
Yeah, it's so funny that when I did present my thesis, I had to present it in front of like the honors faculty, and then I invited way too many people to it. So like faculty asked questions. And this woman was like, she's like, well, what if I want to watch a movie on a plane? I can't like bring any of the things you're talking about on the plane. And I'm like, she just didn't get it. Like she was like, and I was like, I replied back, you know, she's like, don't you think like nobody has any of this equipment anymore? Like blah, 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 blah. And I was like, don't you think that like some people can't afford like laptops that can handle like streaming or like, you know, what they're required to have, like what specs they're required for streaming so they can actually like watch things in the quality that the streamers intend it to be? Or don't you think like some people can't afford to sign up for 5 different streaming services with libraries? And I just like, I know a lot of people, especially I've met some people who live in more rural areas, you know, the last Blockbuster is in Bend, Oregon. You know, I had people tell me that they lived in Bend and like how they watched things was going to that Blockbuster.
Yep.
Like a few years ago. So I don't know. I think some people just, they see the smaller picture as opposed to the bigger picture.
And they've also taken the bait. I mean, you know, for many, many years, they would sell you their movies and they would make 20 or 30 bucks to sell it to you. And then at a certain point they realized, if we don't sell these things, but we essentially rent them to everyone every month, then we make $30 a month from you instead of $30 once, or whatever it is, $15 for HBO Max or, you know, $8 for Disney Plus. So a subscription model where you don't own it, you don't control it, and you have to basically like pay their monthly fee to get whatever you want, the show or the movie. That's a dream for them because it's predictable income. It's not like, ooh, the ET VHS will sell a million copies, but some movie nobody cares about will sell nothing. It's like now they can say we have 70 million Disney Plus subscribers every month who are paying $8. Wall Street, here's our predictable cash flow, you know?
Yeah.
So it's in their interest. And I see people all the time like you use DVDs? What are you, from the Stone Age? You know, and it's like, shut up, because my DVD is never going to go off the service. It's never going to get edited. It's never going to get taken away or go into the vault, right? It's like, it's about control. And so I would say like people need to beware of like towing the line and being like, yeah, physical media is outdated. It's not. It's as good often as you're seeing on streaming. And as you point out, not everybody can afford streaming and not everybody lives in a place where it's even accessible, where broadband is accessible to them. So
yeah.
You know, it always needs to be part of the mix. And I really, really hope it continues to be, because it's such a big part of my life and for so many people I know.
Yeah.
We know.
Yeah.
When stuff is not put out in any legitimate way that you can pay for, you know, search and append okay.ru to the search and you will find like every movie ever made.
Yes.
Love that.
Yes. I also want to give a shout out to Rare Film.
Yeah.
They just got back on and they have such a great selection that's actually like curated really well. So support folks like that. Support Museum of Home Video, who run really great shows on Twitch. Just there's so many people who are doing events online as well as creating websites with curated content that need your support. So, yeah.
There's so many things that are part of the mix. You know, like, you know, earlier today I watched the Silent Comedy Watch Party on YouTube with, you know, Ben Modell. And yesterday I watched a webinar on like classic, like Los Angeles cafeterias, you know, and there are so many people, and I mentioned Kimberly Truller, Glamourmore, who does, you know, film and fashion webinars. There are so many people out there that are doing good, just original stuff. So, you know, definitely support them. And it's, you know, I'm not going to shame anybody for like subscribing to Disney Plus and you know, HBO Max, but also give your money to the like indie people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to shamelessly promote myself that I'm starting a Twitch channel. On Wednesdays, I'm going to be projecting 16 millimeter films, just random reels, and we will all collectively find out if it works and runs through the projector and what it is, and if it's labeled correctly, because a lot of reels that I get aren't labeled correctly. But follow Will on Twitter as well, and, you know, follow some of the social media that he runs as well, because he does a lot of great stuff and is very, his Twitter accounts are very informative, and you can fail his quizzes just like I do.
I love it. And I appreciate all of the, you know, support of you guys over the years. Appreciate your, you know, your passion and enthusiasm. You know, keep it up. I'm a big fan, you know, always here for like, For old man sage advice and words of encouragement.
To all the people listening, we're going to have another guest on, surprise guest for January.
Yeah. And also, I want to again shout out Will on social media. You can find him on Twitter at, just look up Will McKinley. His handle, and then I'm bad with like Instagram, but are you active on Instagram as well?
I am. I'm on Instagram, and if you want to see just tons of pictures of my nieces, Instagram is the place to go.
You can also follow his postings on postings. I don't know if that's the way to say it, but Get TV and the Sony Movie Channel on Twitter and also Instagram. Is that correct?
Yes.
But yeah, thank you so much again. Thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed talking everything that we talked about today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. We'll see everyone next week. Bye.
Bye.